Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Blood loss is one of the greatest threats when there's a gunshot wound. In the immediate aftermath of the Las Vegas mass shooting that claimed the lives of 58 people, medical workers turned to bystanders for help with emergency first aid. Now healthcare professionals have launched a national campaign to raise awareness and provide education on preventing blood loss deaths in the event of a future mass shooting. The Stop the Bleed campaign has already trained hundreds of nurses, teachers, and the general public to control the bleeding in shooting victims. Dr. Lenworth Jacobs is a trauma surgeon and director of the Trauma Institute at Hartford Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. He helped start the Stop the Bleed campaign after the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, which claimed the lives of 26 people, including 20 children. Dr. Jacobs, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
How did the Sandy Hook shooting spur you to action?
Well, it was incredibly distressing. I've been a trauma surgeon for over 40 years and was involved in the aftermath of that, and it's the single most distressing thing I've ever seen. These were six-year-old children, and you can't see that and just do nothing. So that's what spurred us to create a committee, a national committee, to increase survival after these kinds of events.
It's been compared to sort of like the CPR, the cardiopulmonary respiration or resuscitation effort, teaching ordinary people to do what?
Well, if you go back to the beginning, these injuries are severe. So what happens is you lose blood from your body because, generally speaking, a big artery has been disrupted. If that continues for any period of time, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, 10 minutes, you have a high likelihood of dying. So the whole name of the game is to stop the bleeding pretty much immediately and keep the blood inside the body. If you do that, you have a very, very high likelihood of living. In Boston, over 250 people or 200 people got to the hospital. All of them lived. So that the whole thrust is to stop bleeding immediately and keep the blood inside the body.
Is it hard to learn these procedures?
Not at all. We teach three things. Use your hands to hold as tight as you can on the area that's bleeding, and that just basically compresses or squashes the artery, and it'll stop bleeding. That's one. Two, to use what's called a hemostatic dressing, which is like gauze, but it's impregnated with a material which is 10 times more effective in stopping bleeding, and push that into the wound as hard as you can. And then the third is a tourniquet, which is a device which you put around the limb to compress the vessel and stop the bleeding. All of these things any citizen can do in 15 minutes to half an hour.
That is, if you have things like that, the gauze you refer to. The campaign also has made bleeding control kits available in public places. Is that what those they include?
Yes, they do. And so they're now in our own hospital. Beside every automatic external defibrillator is a bleeding control bag. And you can go there and pull out one of these kits and you're ready to go. But they're in malls, they're in Gillette Stadium, that's the Patriot Stadium. They're in schools, they're in churches. It's just a start, but that's the goal. Every time you see an automatic external defibrillator, you should see a bleeding control bag beside it. That is our goal.
What kind of response have you received to your campaign?
It's very good. We pretty much started in January, and we now have 6,500 instructors in all 50 states and 42 countries. So people see this as being part of the solution. It is awful to just see somebody bleeding severely and basically dying. That's awful. What this does is it allows you to get involved, call 911, and immediately become part of the solution. And in so doing, you have a high likelihood of saving a limb or a life. And there is nothing better than that.
You know, when I think of CPR and the training I had in CPR when I was a manager, you know, it's one thing to have somebody in cardiac arrest or something like that and, you know, from natural causes. But when you're talking about a shooter, and victims of a shooter, that's a whole different ball of wax, right?
It really is. And that's why you really have to have some training here, because remember, you're not really treating a limb, you're treating a patient. So, and this person just got either cut with a chainsaw, fell on a stake, or shot. So they're hurting. So you, in fact, when you stop this bleeding, will also, that pressure hurts. So you have to be talking to the patient and saying, take it easy, we're working with you, we'll work with you here, get you to the hospital. If you do that, it also settles you down, because people don't do this every day. But, you know, it could be your child running across the backyard. It could be your significant other with a chainsaw. So it is a skill which every citizen should have.
Anyway, absolutely. Even without these mass shootings.
Absolutely.
What is the hardest part about when I look at people pressing down on a wound like that? It just looks like such a mess. And I wonder, how do they even find out where the wound is?
Well, we have a saying, you can't stop it if you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So the first order of business is to just, you know, sweep the clothing away till you see where it's coming from. And it's obvious, this is life-threatening hemorrhage. So this is, and by the way, all of what I'm talking about is significant bleeding. This is not a cut, shaving, or a little tiny cut which you can put a Band-Aid on.
Mm-hmm.
This is major bleeding. So you clear away the area so you can see, and then press either on it or just what we call proximal or closer to the torso, because the blood's coming from the heart, so you want to be closer to the heart. And just press, press, press. How do you know it's working? No more bleeding. So it's a very, very simple process. And as you see that, there was a lot of blood, there is no more blood, you can then internalize that you've done some good and tell that to the patient. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, the patient's awake, so they will internalize that you're here to help them. Even though you might be hurting them, you are helping them and saving their lives. I would say 99.99% of the people will understand that and will appreciate what you're doing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday. We're talking about stopping somebody from bleeding and perhaps dying from the trauma of blood loss. My guest is Dr. Lenworth Jacobs. He's a trauma surgeon, director of the Trauma Institute at Hartford Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. And he's also one of the founders of a national campaign called Stop the Bleed campaign. It's trained hundreds of nurses, teachers, and just everyday people to control the bleeding in shooting and other trauma victims. If you have a question for Dr. Jacobs, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Does the strategy change at all when it comes to children, Dr. Jacobs?
Well, yes. The technical things don't change. In fact, it's easier, because if you look at your own hands, the muscles there are very small. If you look at your own thigh, the muscles there are very big. So your hands tend to want to get tired. In a child, they're much, much smaller, so it's easier to compress. That's the good news. The bad news is it's a child. Child's going to be very scared. They're going to be hurting. So you have to be doing things, but also talking to the child and reassuring them and being nice and being kind and loving. The good news is it distracts you from what you're doing, so you can really concentrate on the patient and the wound. So yes, it's harder because it's a child,
mm-hmm.
but you also feel as if you are doing some good for the child.
There's been this kind of a thing lately where people are afraid to get involved because they don't want to do damage.
Well, it's interesting. You know, before we went to the public, we did a national survey. And this is all zip codes, old, young, all demography, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And well over about 92% of the people said they would be very interested in becoming involved and stopping bleeding even if they didn't know the person. And that was just terrific.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing was they said that they didn't want to do harm, which is totally understandable. And they were a little concerned about blood. So that's why you really have to work with people to realize you really, it might be hurting the person, but it's doing good. You're not doing harm. And then we advocate using gloves. The problem is, of course, that you don't walk around with gloves in your pocket. So if you were the first person there, you would have to use your own hands. Mm-hmm. And they would become bloody. There's no question about it. But then you would wash them carefully afterwards. And it's a worry, but you are saving a life.
Yeah, it's not an easy way to transfer bloodborne illness, is it?
Not at all. If you don't have a cut or something, it's just, it's. I wouldn't say it's not a factor, but it is not a huge worry.
Zachary in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Jacobs. Welcome to the show, Zachary.
Hello. Thank you for having me on and hosting this this guest, because it's really important. But I called in because I have a rather large printing facility in Clintonville, and we have machines that have safety equipment installed on them, but that safety equipment has failed in other shops in the past, and when it fails, it could sever a limb or something like that. So we're curious, from a privately owned business standpoint, where do we get these kits and this training? What's the cost? And if there are grants or anything like that to subsidize the cost? And then secondly, I grew up in Appalachia and northern Kentucky and southern Ohio, and you keep saying chainsaws, and I'm just thinking, I just turned 30 and bought a chainsaw for my birthday and cut down a huge tree in my new house, and I don't have anything other than like a small road first aid kit. So it would be really good to have something like this in my truck or on my property to ensure that if somebody does get hurt, we can take care of them. So, just curious again, where to get the kits, where to get the training, if there's what the cost is, and if they're expensive, if there's a way to subsidize that cost so we can get it in more people's hands.
Dr. Jacobs?
Those are just excellent questions and comments. The best place for information is what's bleedingcontrol.org, because everything I've said is available there. And also, it has a store part where the kits are available. All the things we deal with are what we call branded or approved by the U.S. military, because the U.S. military has the most experience with this. And every soldier who goes to war has a kit on their belt now and is trained. So these kits are modified from that. They are available in the store, or they're available, commercially. Generally speaking, what we do is we encourage the business or philanthropy to become involved. The kits are about $70 each, and if the ones that go on the wall, there are 8 of those in a kit. We have, in our own hospital, the Women's Auxiliary gave us a grant, and that's what we use to supply all the kits in the hospital.
Zachary, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
And if I can just say, yeah, you really, if you're working around a chainsaw, you really should have one of these. I have one in my car and in my boat, because you say, why a boat? You're a long way from help if you're out on a pond or something. So if somebody gets cut with a prop or has a problem, you need a kit right there with you right now. In fact, we're not there yet, but we're working to put these kits in every single car coming off the line. There's 17 million of those that come off every year. And somebody says, where do I get one of these? Look in your glove compartment. That's the goal. We're not there yet, but that's what our goal would be.
Dr. Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And we'll post that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Dr. Lenworth Jacobs, he's a trauma surgeon and director of the Trauma Institute at Hartford Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. He is also one of the founders of the Stop the Bleed campaign. It's trained hundreds of nurses, teachers, and others to control the bleeding in shooting victims and other trauma victims. So check out that link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Just 5 years ago, people infected with hepatitis C had only bleak treatment options. The only drug at the time came with a lot of side effects, and it wasn't very effective. Then a revolutionary pill came along that had a 90% cure rate. But despite that efficacy, it costs about $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment, or about $1,000 a pill. Another drug has hit the market. It costs less. The course of treatment is shorter, just 8 weeks, and it cures all six genetic types of hepatitis C. Joining us by phone is Senior Hepatologist at the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. William Carey. Welcome back, Dr. Carey.
Well, thank you, Ann, very much. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Also with us is Ed Silverman. Ed has covered the pharmaceutical industry for more than two decades. He's a senior writer and PharmaLot columnist for Stat News. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's first talk about this latest drug, this new drug approved by the FDA. It's called Mavirat. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. The drug treats hepatitis C in just 8 weeks only. It costs about $26,400, I guess a bargain basement compared to the other one. What's different about this, Ed Silverman?
Well, as you noted, it can treat the six different genotypes, which is a big advantage because that encompasses so much of the U.S. patient population, whereas the previously available or the other drugs only focus on certain genotypes, and while they can hit a lot of the patient population, it's not everybody. So that's a big advantage and distinction right there.
And it makes it cheaper because of that? It's got the economies of scale that way?
Well, there's more to the calculus than that. The company that's selling this drug, AbbVie, is trying to gain market share, win market share away from the dominant player, Gilead Sciences, which was first out of the gate a few years ago, as you mentioned. So it's a bit of a jockeying right now for prominence with the health insurers, and they're trying very hard to gain as much revenue as they can while there's still enough people who are untreated in this country.
How many people are untreated still?
Well, it depends upon the estimate. It could be anywhere from 180,000 to perhaps 200,000 in the U.S. right now. Although that's expected to decline over the next several years by half that much.
Dr. Carey, what was the big breakthrough? The other drug, Harvoni, is a 12-week regimen, and that was in more of the $65,000 to $90,000 range, all things being equal. What was the breakthrough with Harvoni and then again with this Mavirat? I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
Yeah, okay, so that's an excellent question. You know, this Harvoni's been around for a couple of years now, and it really is the number one seller for hepatitis C treatment, and it's very, very good. You know, it has few, if any, side effects, few headaches, a little gastrointestinal upset, but very, very well tolerated. It doesn't have the ability to treat every hepatitis C genotype, so you have to be careful about, well, what genotype do you have, and do you have cirrhosis or not, and you know, those things matter a lot less with the newer drugs. There's actually two of them out there that are pan-genotypic, that is, they'll be effective against genotype 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The Mavirat is the one that has just come on market. Epclusa is another pan-genotypic drug, which is awfully good, too. So single dose per day, freedom from side effects, and highly effective. Those are the things that are now attributes of currently available hepatitis C treatment.
And treatment before interferon was horrible side effects, not much, still pretty expensive, and it would go on for as long as a year, right?
It was really ugly. It was really ugly treatment. You know, I was just reviewing the very first paper that came out on interferon-based therapy, and interferon alone cured maybe 18%. You add ribavirin to pegylated interferon, you're up to 40, 50%. Compared to the new drugs, which are much shorter duration and have a likelihood of success in the 95 to 98% likelihood range. So vast difference in everything.
So, Ed Silverman, what's different about these new drugs? What are they doing differently?
Well, the newest drugs, they can, as you heard, they can treat all the different genotypes, so that's like casting the wide net.
Right.
The beyond that, you're seeing the inklings of a pricing war. The market has shifted. It's not been just two players over the past few years. Gilead, which sells Harvoni, and the newer Eclusa, were first out of the gate. AbbVie, which sells Mavyret, also sells another drug. They were the second to the market. Then Merck came along, but Merck is a bit of a niche player. And right now, though, the market is really divided between Gilead and AbbVie, with Merck a distant third. But it's really a question of then there were two, because in the last few weeks and months, Merck ceased halted development of another entrant, another drug. Johnson & Johnson bowed out. Bristol-Myers Squibb, another manufacturer, ended development. So you've got two companies that are jockeying to get marketplace dominance with their latest treatments. And what's happening is they're dividing up what's going to be a smaller pie over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because hepatitis C is a slow-moving disease. Many of the sick patients have already been treated the last few years, and the healthier ones are probably going to hold off getting prescriptions and getting treated because the medicines are expensive. And by the way, the prices cited, those are what's called list prices. They're not actually the prices that are typically paid. Initially, because Gilead was the only competitor, it was getting close to the full price. But since then, there has been competition, and prices, the actual paid prices, have come down because insurers are paying a combination of rebates and discounts. But it's still a sizable amount of money, and so we're not going to see everybody get treated immediately.
Dr. Curie, it seems like a no-brainer in terms of what you would prescribe. Wouldn't it automatically be the Mavyret?
Short answer, yes. A lot of it has to do, though, with what Ed has alluded to, and that is the list price is not necessarily what is being paid by the insurance companies that cover the cost of these things. But if we just take at face value the list price that's being offered, Mavyret, I think, is going to really come to number one very, very quickly, and for good reason. 98% likelihood of cure, few side effects. 8 to 12 weeks of therapy, maybe even less coming down the line. No need for ribavirin treatment. Doesn't matter whether you have renal failure or not. It really looks like a winner of a drug, and they priced it better. I hesitate to say they priced it right, because you can get treated for hepatitis C in Egypt for $500. So $13,200 a month is still a very, very pricey drug.
Why is it different in Egypt than here?
Well, because it's very clear that in Egypt nobody could pay $13,000 a month for treatment. So the drug companies have agreed to really give a high discount and make it possible to treat people in other countries. So it shows you the force that can be applied if you have a big market and the ability to deal with pharmaceutical companies to compete for price.
What's the difference between hepatitis A, B, and C, Dr. Curie?
Well, hepatitis A is an infection that is usually in contaminated food, and it will come and find you, okay? Hepatitis B and hepatitis C are viruses which are usually associated with some sort of high-risk behavior or blood transfusions before the 1992 time when blood was being tested. So you get them in different ways. Hepatitis A is a self-limited disease. Hepatitis B and C may become chronic, may last forever.
And there's acute, and then there's chronic hep C. What's the difference?
Well, acute means short-acting, so that, for example, someone with hepatitis C may get good and sick for a few days or a few weeks, but by the time 2 or 3 months runs by, they're back to normal. The hepatitis A has gone away, and they have a normal liver, and they'll do fine. Someone who's got hepatitis B or hepatitis C may have it for the rest of their life. It's interesting. The CDC reported that hepatitis C-related deaths are higher than the combined number of deaths from 60 other infectious diseases reported, including HIV, tuberculosis, pneumococcal pneumonia, etc. So it is a big deal, and it kills a lot of people.
It kills a lot of people, but it's slow-moving, like you said.
Yep. A long fuse on this bomb. a long hue. So it takes years, decades, for the disease to play out, developing cirrhosis, developing liver cancer, the need for a transplant, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, Ed Silverman, it's kind of hard to imagine a 12-week regimen of anything costing $80,000 or $90,000. Is that, can you talk about the pricing and how they come to that, whether it's the sticker price, you know, price or not?
Well, there was a U.S. Senate Finance Committee investigation that was issued about a year and a half ago that took Gilead Sciences, which was first out of the gate a few years ago with the new generation of hepatitis C drugs called Sovaldi, and took the company to task for, paraphrasing, effectively disregarding affordability issues in this country. You know, the pharmaceutical industry in general is accused of using the U.S. to finance its operations and activities elsewhere by charging higher prices here. And in this particular case, though, Gilead was criticized for taking that too far. And you asked about Egypt before.
Mm-hmm.
Gilead subsequently struck a deal with generic companies based in India to license the rights to make lower-cost generic versions of Sovaldi available in dozens of other countries around the world, mostly low-income countries. And Gilead did that to sort of get ahead of the curve, as I call it, because the company wanted to avoid the sort of far-reaching negative publicity that hurt drug makers 20 years ago with the AIDS crisis. And Gilead tried to staunch that possibility by reaching that deal so access prices could be lower elsewhere. But getting back to this country, the companies charge, we have a different system of payment. You know, we have private insurance, we have public agencies. It's a mishmash. And so a company can exploit that in different ways, and that's what happened in this case.
Is there any sense, Dr. Carey, that when a generic is done in India for lower costs, that it's a lower quality product?
Well, that's always the concern, and I think you have to take it drug by drug by drug and mm-hmm. not make any blanket statement about the equivalence of biosimilars or generic drugs. I'm not aware of any evidence that the drugs that are being made for hepatitis C are of lesser quality or less effective. Ed may know information about that, but it's not come to my attention.
Mm-hmm. Ed?
There have been attempts to quantify that, but Dr. Carey's right. You do have to take it drug by drug and company by company, because it's unfair and probably impossible to make a generalized statement that generics may be more problematic. I think what's more precise would be to determine the extent to which a generic works appropriately for an individual simply because of the way it's composed and how it breaks down in the body. But that's different than a manufacturing issue.
Dr. Carey, what was the breakthrough in science that brought about these new drug treatments, whether it's Harvoni or Mavyret? What was it that changed so much?
So that's a great question. And what's different about the drugs that we're talking about today is that they are actually antiviral agents. Interferon did not act against the virus. It augmented the immune system to attack the virus. So it was Michael Houghton back in the 1980s that basically described many of the steps that are involved in the production of hepatitis C virus. And once those things have been identified, then molecules have been developed by drug companies against each of these targets. So that today, most often, the pills that we use are combinations of drugs, each of which acts at a different target in the hepatitis C viral machinery.
Has this informed other research into other viral treatments?
Well, I think it's analogous to HIV treatment,
okay,
where usually combinations of drugs are used and much more effective than single drugs used by themselves.
Dr. William Carey, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time as always.
You're quite welcome.
Dr. William Carey, senior hepatologist in the Department of Gastroenterology at the Cleveland Clinic. And also Ed Silverman, thanks to you. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Ed Silverman is a senior writer and PharmaLot columnist for Stat News. He's covered the pharmaceutical industry for two decades. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Reconstructive or plastic surgery seems like a modern phenomenon, but it's really been around for thousands of years, and undergoing nip-and-tuck surgery is becoming more popular than ever. In 2015, about 16 million Americans went under the knife. That's 2% increase from the year before. But cosmetic surgery is still surgery, and it's not always just for the looks. We're talking about its safety. Dr. Jeffrey Janis was recently appointed president or elected president of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. He is a professor in the Department of Plastic Surgery at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you, Ann. Happy to be here.
Why is it called plastic surgery?
Well, in actuality, the word comes from an ancient Greek word, plastikos, and in essence, the object is to restore or to make whole. So what we try to do is give people back what they've lost or make them even better than they already are.
It's associated, the practice of plastic surgery is associated with, the beauty industry and that kind of a thing, but it's really about a lot more than that, right?
Absolutely. I think most people think plastic surgery is just cosmetic surgery, and of course there is that element of it, but there's also the reconstructive element of it, which I think probably doesn't get as much airtime. But in essence, there's a lot of training that goes into making an American Board of Plastic Surgery board-certified plastic surgeon, years' worth of training in order to become a safe and competent plastic surgeon who can do a number of procedures in order to help patients. And in some cases, that's cosmetic surgery, and in some cases, that's reconstructive surgery, and of course, in some cases, that's both.
I mentioned the increase in the number of people getting plastic surgery. What's driving that, do you know?
You know, it's hard to say. I think that more and more these days, certainly you see plastic surgery in the media, and I think that that's a good thing because whether it's listening here on the radio today or on TV or even good word of mouth, I think maybe decades ago, this was the type of thing that was not discussed as openly as it is today. But I really enjoy the opportunity to have this type of discussion with patients. Patients actually like to talk to each other about the plastic surgery and options that exist. And of course, as you're aware, even the federal government has mandates on offering reconstruction to both children and adults who need it. For instance, patients who have breast cancer are entitled to breast reconstruction surgery and need to know their options. So the answer to the question is that we're talking about it more, which is a good thing.
What are the most common procedures?
Well, on the cosmetic side, of course, it would be what you might expect, things like breast augmentation, liposuction, nose reshaping or rhinoplasty, something called blepharoplasty, which would be an eyelid tuck, so to speak, or facelift. On the reconstruction side, really that's going to be a lot of things that involve reconstruction after cancer, for instance, breast reconstruction, like what we've just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But plastic surgeons are also involved in reconstruction after trauma, in case patients may find themselves in an unfortunate situation where they get into a car accident, for instance, or in some cases may have complications of other surgeries. Plastic surgeons really collaborate with a lot of other doctors in order to provide the best care to patients possible.
Are doctors either or? Are plastic surgeons either or? Are they either cosmetic or reconstructive, or do some do both, or what?
Well, and some are, but all of us receive broad training. And so when we graduate from training, you know, people are able to do and still are able to do cosmetic and reconstructive surgery. But as some people gravitate towards one specific area of interest, essentially you have some that become aesthetic surgeons and some that become reconstructive surgeons. But in my mind, they're two sides of the same coin. Let's take breast reconstruction. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of your listeners would argue that breast reconstruction is just a reconstructive surgery. There, of course, is a very strong aesthetic or cosmetic component to that. So in my mind, it's really hard to separate the two. When you do reconstructive surgery, you're always thinking about how it looks. When you do cosmetic surgery, that's also a type of reconstruction.
There are risks associated with plastic surgery, even if it's cosmetic, right?
There are. There's risks associated with any surgery, mm-hmm. but the idea is to minimize those risks. Now, there are some things that that you can do something about. Let's give some specific examples. Let's take smoking, for example. Smoking is an option. It's a choice. And people who start smoking can take a break from it or can stop completely. And so when we're doing either cosmetic or reconstructive surgery, we like our patients to be in the best shape possible in order to give them the best outcome possible. So in that situation, you know, we might ask our patients to please have no nicotine in their system so that we can avoid complications. Other things may not be able to be changed, but some things can. Diabetes, for instance, if some people have high blood sugars, we can work with their primary care physicians and their family doctors in order to get those blood sugars down to a safe level so that we can operate on them in a safe way. So there are some things that can be done to make patients safer candidates. In other situations, there may not be.
What is the threat of nicotine? Why does that affect the outcome?
Well, as simple as I can make it, everything that gets cut has to heal, and it heals by blood delivering oxygen to that area so that it can heal properly. So if you can't deliver the oxygen, then things are not going to heal very well. Imagine driving down 71 or 70 or 270, and let's say that we cut the number of lanes down by half. How easy is it going to be to get from one place to another when you've cut down the lanes by half? That's what happens with smoking. Smoking decreases the size of a blood vessel by half. As a matter of fact, there was a study that was published in the 70s that says that one cigarette decreases the amount of blood flow to your fingertips by 42%. So let's just call that almost half. That's what I mean when I say that if you try to drive your car down the freeway and you cut the number of lanes by half, it's just going to take a lot longer to get there. And that's the same situation in the body as it is on the road.
Are there ethics associated with plastic surgery when it comes to cosmetic surgery, and whether or not a patient, just because they want to have a procedure done, maybe they're not fit for it, maybe it's not good health?
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. And there is a code of ethics that we all adhere to when you become a member of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, which actually has nearly 95% of all American Board of Plastic Surgery board certified plastic surgeons are members of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. And when you're in that situation, you adhere to a code of ethics. And that code of ethics basically says exactly what you've just said, which is that we will properly evaluate each and every individual patient to be sure that they are an appropriate patient for surgery. There are some patients who come in who may not be an appropriate candidate for surgery, and we are not in the business of doing surgery just to do surgery. We are in the business of trying to make people happy and trying to make people restored and to feel whole again. And the object is not to operate on every single person, it's to operate on the people who need it and who are appropriate candidates for it.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about plastic surgery with the new president of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, Dr. Jeffrey Janis. He's a professor of plastic surgery at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question or comment about plastic surgery, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. Dr. Janis, a 2016 report from the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery showed that the number of people 65 and older getting facelifts and cosmetic eyelid surgeries had more than doubled over the last two decades. That's pretty amazing. So there's a couple issues here. Number one, does age impact the effectiveness of the surgery, and can it affect the safety of the surgery? And I guess I wonder, are people 65 and older just healthier in general, and that's why that older age group is getting more of it done?
Well, again, I think that a lot of people talk more freely about plastic surgery, and I think that you know, when you look at the rising popularity, it's actually not just in the age group of 65 or older. You're actually seeing a large increase in plastic surgery really across most age groups just in general. But to your earlier point about safety, you know, I really want to emphasize that to the listeners out there that age is a factor, but it's not a hard stop. We're going to evaluate every patient, whether they're 15, 25, 55, 65, to make sure that if they are a candidate for surgery, that we do it in the safest way possible. We do that in several ways. You know, obviously, number one, that's our training. If you were to ask me whether you're a cosmetic or a reconstructive plastic surgeon, you know, what are the top three goals of any operation? I would tell you it's safety, safety, and safety, and then we're going to talk about what number four is and afterwards. We need to also practice our surgery in the right place, which means at an accredited surgery center or hospital that, again, is accredited. What does accredited mean? It means that you've had essentially people coming in, checking out the hospital or surgery center and make sure that it is completely up to code and standard. So this is not performing surgery in some closet, some basement, or some back room. The plastic surgeons who are involved in the American Society of Plastic Surgeons all are operating in accredited surgery centers or hospitals. And that's important for your listeners to know, because it's not just who does it, it's where they do it. And in terms of the 65-year-old person getting a facelift, again, if they're an appropriate individual who wants surgery and it is safe to perform it, then we will offer it. But we will not offer surgery to people who are just not candidates for it. So that's a very individualized basis. You know, each patient is evaluated one at a time. That's how we treat our patients, one person at a time.
Have there been any particular advancements in plastic surgery and cosmetic and reconstructive surgery in recent years that have made it better, made it more effective?
Yeah, I mean, we're always pushing the boundaries of what we do. If you take a look at actually the history of medicine, it took nearly 100 to 200 years to double the amount of medical knowledge. You know, when you take a look back into the early 1900s, and then in between the Great Depression and World War II, we doubled the amount of medical knowledge that we've had. And actually, these days, the amount of medical knowledge doubles roughly every 1.5 years. So if you take a look at where we've been in medicine and where we're going, all of us, not just in plastic surgery, but all of us are really making a lot of great strides and advancements. In plastic surgery, we've come up with a number of different innovations, one of which that I was involved with in the past back in 2011 was around face transplantation. And I'm sure your listeners have probably heard about that. But when you talk about the ability to give something back to patients that they have lost, through a lot of innovations in plastic surgery, we've been able to give people back, faces, scalps. There's been obviously finger replantation, arm replantation, leg replantation. There's a lot of advancements in plastic surgery that enable us to give back to patients what they have lost. And so there truly is a lot of innovation going on.
Is limb replantation part of plastic surgery?
It is.
Oh, okay.
It is. And that's something that maybe listeners may not be aware of. Plastic surgeons are hand surgeons. Plastic surgeons are reconstructive surgeons. If you're on a jet ski, if you are involved in some sort of car accident and you lose a finger or a hand or an arm, you know, and you get to the hospital, chances are there's a plastic surgeon involved in your care.
Do you, well, we've all seen the pictures of botched procedures, and to some extent that's in the eye of the beholder. Sometimes I see the results of plastic surgery that some famous person has had, and I just think they look terrible, that they should have just stuck with their natural aging. But that's just a personal, subjective thing. But then there's the botched procedures. And what happens in those cases? What do we know about why that happens?
Well, you know, each one of those probably has an individual circumstance, mm-hmm. so it's probably difficult to make a blanket statement about that. The fact of the matter is that, you know, there can be complications within any procedure that's performed, whether it's removing a mole from the skin or whether you're doing something more major. But, you know, it's truly botched is in the eye of the beholder as well. You know, sometimes a patient will go through surgery and have an incredible outcome, but they themselves may look at it and say, well, you know, I wish it could be better. And I think we all have seen that in the media and heard about that. And those are the people that ultimately get, you know, several plastic surgeries. And that's something, again, that really needs to be evaluated on an individual basis. You know, I can assure you that when patients come into our clinics and they would like to have something done, you know, we like to treat them very much like individuals and listen to what they are looking for and make sure that we can provide that in a safe and effective way.
Is there a mental health component here, though? Is there any screening for that to make sure that people have a healthy approach to what they're doing?
No question. There's actually been a lot of research behind this, and that you know, you do have a mental health component to probably any surgery that you perform. But there's something out there called body dysmorphic disorder, which actually affects between 6 and 11% of the population, and that's essentially where you kind of look in the mirror and you take a look at something, and little things become big things, and it doesn't matter how much surgery you get or how many people you see. You just always feel like you're not happy. And if we don't recognize the fact that there is a mental and an emotional component to our patients, then we're not seeing the whole picture. Surgery is not going to help those patients, and it's our responsibility to help recognize, you know, who might carry that diagnosis and how to get them the help that they need. But the help that they need is not the knife in that situation.
Is there an obligation on the part of the you know, in the industry, the practice of plastic surgery to help people age gracefully?
Absolutely. You know, the object of plastic surgery is not to put somebody in the witness protection program. the object of plastic surgery is to listen to what people say and to help make them feel more youthful, more, how should I say this? When somebody looks in the mirror every morning and they see somebody in the mirror looking back at them, the biggest thing that I hear from my patients is that they don't look how they feel. And so when that happens, they probably just kind of go about that day by day, and they get to a point where they say, you know what, I really would like to see what my options are. And when those patients come in, I always emphasize to them that the goal is not to make them look like somebody else. The goal is to make them look like themselves, just more refreshed, more youthful, and more vibrant.
Dr. Jeffrey Janis, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Honored to be here, Ann. Thank you.
Dr. Jeffrey Janis, professor of plastic surgery at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, and also the new president of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.